Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. On this month's program, we look back at the life of Bob Tucker of Bloomington, a movie theater projectionist who also published more than 20 novels and became a superstar among science fiction fans. We check in with the National Toy Hall of Fame to learn about its latest inductees, and we talk to a champagne woman who has created a line of cards called Pardonne-moi, which uses humor to deal with everyday social annoyances. Those stories and more, this time, on Sidetrack. To many who knew him in the Bloomington Normal area, Arthur Wilson Tucker, Bob to his friends, was a movie theater projectionist and family man. He was active in his union local and worked occasionally as a stage electrician for Illinois State University. But Tucker, who died recently at the age of 91, was also a published author who wrote over 20 science fiction and mystery novels. And for a small but widespread community, he was a beloved celebrity. Jim Meadows reports.
In 1935, as America was struggling to escape the Depression, 20-year-old Bob Tucker of Bloomington was waging a war against the use of wire staples to bind pulp magazines. He waged it in the letter column of the pulp science fiction monthly Astounding Stories, where he argued that chewing gum was a superior binding method.
Wire staples are detours on the path to utopia. Remove them, replace them with gum binding, and the mag stands itself up. Open at any desired place while you eat your morning mush.
Bob Tucker was kidding. The Great Staple War, as it was called, was a joke that Tucker and his co-conspirators played out in the Astounding Stories letter column for several months. It marked Tucker's role among the far-flung community of isolated, intense young men who believed that science fiction carried a hopeful vision of the future. Science fiction editor and publisher Tony Weisskopf says Tucker was influential among those early fans, many of whom, like Tucker himself, would become professional science fiction writers.
One of the things he did to help shape the science fiction subculture was burst the bubble of pretension that many of the young and earnest science fiction fans had in the 30s and 40s. He was able to take a step back and poke fun at the overly zealous criticisms and personal attacks that could occur back then.
But if Tucker could joke about being a science fiction fan, he was serious about science fiction. In a 1975 interview, he said it was the only fiction he preferred reading over nonfiction. He sold his first short story in 1941, and for the next 40 years, dozens of short stories and novels, both science fiction and mystery, appeared under his pen name, Wilson Tucker. James Gunn directs the Center for the Study of Science Fiction at the University of Kansas. He says Tucker saw writing as more an avocation than a profession and never pursued it full time.
He was a union movie projectionist, and he said there was lots of time in the movie booth between changing reels, and so he'd mostly do his thinking about writing then, and maybe even some of the writing itself.
The Wilson Tucker novels that impress Gunn the most are told in the context of several centuries and dramatic social changes. In The Lincoln Hunters, published in 1958, a 26th-century historian named Ben Stewart travels back in time to record a lost speech by a nearly forgotten figure named Abraham Lincoln. In the novel, Tucker refers to an actual speech that Lincoln delivered in Bloomington in 1856. In this excerpt, Stewart struggles not to blow his cover as he watches Lincoln speak.
Startled, Stewart swung his attention around. He found Lincoln's eyes locked with his. Stewart nodded gravely and sought to appear in agreement with whatever had been said, but inwardly he was alarmed. A phrase or two, or perhaps a complete sentence, slipped by unheard as he struggled to remain calm and not fall from character. Very casually, as though to scratch the skin around his collar, he lifted his hand to his neck to determine if the microphone had somehow slipped from concealment.
While many science fiction writers of his generation were upbeat about the future, Tucker was often the opposite. Much of The Lincoln Hunters centers on Stewart's discovery that he prefers 19th-century America to his own highly regimented version of 700 years later. Weisskopf says Tucker's view of society and his characters was clear-eyed and unsentimental.
I think Tucker had the anthropologist's ability to step back and look at his subjects without emotional involvement, and that attitude does come through in the fiction. He took human beings for what they were, foibles and aspirations and all.
In his most prolific period, Tucker published about a novel a year, all written in his spare time. At the same time, he stayed heavily involved in science fiction fandom, publishing and writing for amateur magazines known as fanzines, and meeting other fans at conventions. It was at these gatherings that Tucker became famous for a social ritual involving a line from an old Red Skelton routine and his favorite drink, Jim Beam's Choice Bourbon Green Label, aged 5 years. Tucker's friend and fellow science fiction fan Keith Stokes saw the bourbon ritual played out many times.
He would take a sip of it, and he'd pass it to the next person, and they would take one and pass along. If someone happened not to be a drinker, they could just take a sniff at the top of the bottle and continue to pass it. And as it went around the circle, they'd each hold up their right hand until it came back to Bob. And then Bob would take one more sip, and then everyone would bring their right arm down in a sweeping gesture to the front together and go smooth.
The smooth routine became Tucker's trademark among his fellow science fiction fans, who knew him not so much as Wilson Tucker published author, but Bob Tucker, fellow fan. Witty and gregarious, Tucker wrote at least as much for fanzines as he did for professional markets. He was a frequent guest at fan conventions as far away as England and Australia, and could always be relied on for an entertaining speech. Here's a snippet of a Bob Tucker speech from around 1980, captured on an audio cassette fanzine published by Larry Tucker, no relation. Tucker imagines his side of a telephone call, where he tries to get past the front desk at a science fiction magazine.
Put me through to Stan Smith, please. My name is Wilson Tucker. No, you spell it with a T. I'm a writer. Writer. I'm one of those people who churns out all those millions of words that keeps the advertisements apart.
He was a charming person, genuinely interested in people.
Tony Weisskopf.
And he went out of his way to meet people, to orient them at science fiction conventions, to introduce them to other people, to make them feel comfortable in this subculture. And he made a difference in hundreds of people's lives that way.
Weisskopf says she's researching Tucker's life for a possible biography, not because of his fiction writing, but because of his impact as a fan.
As I learned more about him, I realized how important this one person's impact was on a unique American subculture, that of science fiction fandom, science fiction readers, and those who produce science fiction writers and artists and so on. And I was struck at telling the tale of this person, the moral of which is that one person can make a difference.
Bob Tucker was in Florida this past October visiting a daughter when he died of congestive heart failure. Keith Stokes got the news of Tucker's death in suburban St. Louis, where he was attending a science fiction convention. That same weekend, he and some of Tucker's other close friends from science fiction fandom shared their memories of him before a convention crowd he estimated at around 1,000.
We each shared a few words that we had about Bob, and then took a bottle of Beam's Choice Bourbon, and in a longtime tradition of Bob's, passed it down between each of us, and then although the audience could not share the beams, everyone held up the right arm and then very slowly brought it down sweepingly, saying smooth. We were saying goodbye to Bob by smoothing him.
Tony Weisskopf says Tucker stopped writing professionally as he neared 70 and saw that his abilities were declining. 25 years later, his Wilson Tucker science fiction and mystery novels are largely out of print. But Weisskopf says her company, Bain Books, is interested in republishing his fiction online in the form of e-books. I'm Jim Meadows.
This is Sidetrack. Ever find yourself in an annoying social situation where you wish you had a quick quip to present to the source of the annoyance? Well, there's a Champagne woman who can help you out. Her name is Amy Wicker, and she has created a series of cards called Pardonne-moi, which she hopes people will use to broach the delicate subject of social etiquette. Wicker recently stopped by the WILL studios for a chat. We started with her reading some of her cards.
Here is one. The reason why I started this company was based on some experiences I had had with my 2-year-old daughter, who's got a compromised immune system and severe food allergies. So I was always irked when I would go out into public and see other parents who would bring their sick kids out into public. I'm like, you know, for those kids who are healthy, who go out into public, you know, you want to be able to go out and safely do things and not have to worry about them coming home sick, which we picked up everything. So I needed a way to communicate to other parents to say, hey, keep your sick kid away from my kid because she's high risk and we'll end up in the emergency room, which we tend to do quite often. So here's one card, for example. Pardonne-moi, I couldn't help but notice that your child is coughing up a lung. Unless that's a trick for the school talent show, I'd suggest keeping him home so the other children don't start practicing it as well. This one really goes to the core of what this is all about. Here's one. This is from the airline travel edition. Pardonne-moi, the waiting area is for everyone. Any chance I could go rock, paper, scissors with your laptop? Let me see. What else do we have here? Pardonne-moi, I couldn't help but notice that you have food in your teeth. You look delicious enough on your own. It would always irk me when I would be out to dinner with friends, and I'd be sitting there, and I'd have, like, spinach in my teeth, and 2 hours later I would realize it in the restroom. And I'm like, you know, people, I'm strong enough to handle that. Why don't you tell me? This is a way for people to just slide it over to you. You know, it can be done very subtly. You get the point across. Do you want me to keep going?
No, well, the question
is... Do you like these?
I like those. I like those a lot. Have you actually used
them?
Yes.
No. That's going to be the big thing. This fall, I mean, we're entering flu season now. So I will be carrying around the parent edition with me as I go out with my child. And normally when I see a parent now with a sick child, I might mention something, you know, about keeping the kid away. But as far as using these, I have not.
Because I was wondering, because some of those, you know, they're a little funny and they're a little bit of a bite to them.
Yeah,
and
right.
I was wondering, you know, have you had people come back to you with experiences of people's reaction when they get these cards?
Yeah, no, you know, it's been interesting because... As I take these, and I've taken these up to, I've been to a few events in Chicago and around town. I've had a number of focus groups. And in general, most people really like reading them, and they think they're a lot of fun. We wanted to make them fun and entertaining. I've received one email from a mom here in Champaign who thought she'd actually received one. She thought her daughter had been given one at school, and it was actually this one with your child coughing up a lung.
Oh.
So she was going, kind of describing the litany of emotions and feelings that she went through as she read the card. She was embarrassed. She was hurt. She was, you know, upset. Nobody could tell her, you know, face to face. So that was really good data and good feedback to get. I think everybody has a different sensitivity level. My hope is that as more people understand what these cards are about and the purpose and the intent, they will maybe take it a little bit easier. They won't take it so offensively or be so hurt by it. Because clearly, you know, we're in situations every day where we have to address some people have a harder time confronting others. So this is really a tool to help them. And you would hope, and I encourage everyone, you know, if you have an issue, you need to directly communicate one-on-one with that person. I think that is the right thing to do. But if you're in a situation where you can't or you're not sure what you should say, this is when the cards can help you. And, you know, if people want to, I recommend them, you know, you can write your name on it. You can sign it so it's not done, you know, anonymously, that type of thing. So it will be real interesting as we get the cards out to see kind of what the reactions are. And I actually see these going over, I see these being more popular in the metropolitan areas than I do in say, a place like Champaign.
When you might not know the person and there might be sort of, you have to deal with the social situation and you just don't know how.
Right.
Generations ago, we had etiquette books. We had, you know, these I guess, laws of society that were, you know, written down and everyone kind of knew them. That, within the last, you know, 50 or so years has changed. Mm-hmm. And these cards remind me a bit of maybe trying to get back to those rules of etiquette in a way, those at least to have some form, some structure.
Well, it's, you know what, I view this as like, I view this as kind of an edgy Miss Manners, if you will. You know, obviously, we're actually going to be sending the cards out to Miss Manners to get her input and reaction to them. So I think that will be actually quite helpful when we get her feedback on the cards. But that's really what we're trying to do. Some people would say, you know what, it's just not appropriate to deal with those types of issues. You're dealing with issues that are extremely sensitive and may not be taken well. But I am a communicator, and I value when someone says to me, you know, I have a problem with what you're doing with this. I mean, I'm strong enough. I can handle it. I can take it. And I appreciate that kind of feedback. Not everybody does. These cards aren't for everybody, clearly. I know that. But I'm kind of hoping, I kind of feel, and I know a lot of people agree with me, that people today just either aren't as aware of their impact, of their behavior, and what that impact is on other people. So in some respects, I want to kind of draw attention to that again and say, you know what, your actions affect other people. Your sick child, you know, could my child could end up in the hospital because of your sick child. Please take a moment and think about that. So I really want to draw attention to say, hey, let's look at where we are today. I don't necessarily think we're in a good place today, and I myself am guilty of a number of things. I think my caller ID, for example, isn't working right now at my house. And you know what? It's great because I answer the phone every time it rings. And I'm like, those little things make a big difference. And so people have said to me, oh, I can't believe you answered the phone. I said, yeah, I'm actually here. And my caller ID isn't working, so I don't know who's calling me. And that's a good thing. You know, it's like I know if somebody calls me and they're chatty patty and I don't have time to talk, I probably won't pick up the phone unless I have an hour when I can talk to them. So little things, I think, can make a difference. And I think that's what I'm trying to do here is just say, hey, let's think about our behavior and our impact. And nobody likes to be called on bad behavior. Nobody does. And, it, you know, so that's hard to take it on occasion. And I just want people to think about, you know, their behavior. And maybe if people are, if you get a card, my hope is you'll think twice about sending your child out sick again or that kind of thing.
And also you're trying to open up at least some line of communication, I guess.
Yeah.
You have these different categories.
Right.
And you've talked about the parenting. What other ones do you have?
We have a pack for the office place, the professional edition. Here's one, for example. Pardon me, I couldn't help but notice that you were distracted by your cell phone during our meeting. Although setting the perfect ringtone is very important, it just gets a point across to say, hey, you know, I noticed your behavior. It wasn't the best. There's the aviation. We have the parenting one. We also have a marriage edition, and I'll give you one of these. Here's one. Pardon moi, dear. We need to talk because talking is much more comfortable than sleeping on the couch. Here's another one. Pardon moi, dear. I couldn't help but notice that you left the toilet seat up. I noticed because I took a dip in Lake Porcelain. There are certain things I wanted to do with the marriage pack. It's like, how many times can you tell your spouse to do this or to do that? And I tried to find those annoying little situations where we that tend to really grate. And we wanted to just put them in kind of a fun way to get your message across. We have the roommate pack, which I think is actually quite good. Here's one. Pardon moi, your share of the rent is late. If our apartment was a girl, it would be pregnant by now. Here's another one. Pardon moi, I couldn't help but notice that according to the chores schedule, it's your turn to take out the trash. If that pile gets any higher, it's going to be declared a national monument. Just, you know, little reminders. And everybody, you know, like I said, everybody's got a different sensitivity level. Mm-hmm. And so we'll see how they go over.
Now, did you write these all yourself?
No, I actually have two comedy writers who live in L.A. They're both from the Chicago area, and they are writing the content. I do the setups, and then they'll write the punchlines and make them funny. Very talented. Our logo work, I know with radio you can't see it, but we've got some fun logos that we're using. The logo work was designed by an actor at Second City, so he's doing all of our artwork and sketches for us. So it's really been it's been a lot of fun to do this. It's just we've all had a great time doing it.
So. Now, have you tested those out and different parts of the country? Because, of course, you know, the Midwest is different than, say, New York, which is different than L.A. Which
Champagne
is
very polite.
Yeah.
People are very polite here.
Yeah.
So as my husband said to me, you know, I'd be surprised if you sold 20 packs in Champagne. I said, yeah, I know, I agree. These, I think, are going to be something that go over more so in the metropolitan areas. I'm just now getting them out to different parts of the country for feedback. So far, as people see them, they've been pretty positive. Now, I don't have a lot of data on the recipients, on those who've received them. I've got a place on my website where I'm really encouraging and I'm hoping people will write in about their experiences. I want to hear from people who receive them as well as people, those situations when they've used them to see how they're going over. We have been working on the tone. We're still working on the tone a little bit. I think that's the thing that will continue to evolve as we move forward.
Now, the holidays are coming up.
Yeah, they're great stocking stuffers.
Well, that of course, but do you have any cards that cover holiday situations? We've got holiday parties. We've got maybe relatives who come over and stay too long.
Right. No, we don't have any of those. Oh. We have got, it's a great idea. We've got a lot of additional packs in the works. We're going to be coming out with, which I think will be very helpful and very good, we're going to be coming out with a parent-teen pack. Possibly a parent with a young adult living at home. We're also going to come out with a pack for teenagers on how to say no to different various situations. So I think the cards can really do some good if done right.
Now, how many packs are there total?
There's seven different packs to choose from.
And that there are more on the way.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And if people want to find out more about them, or if they want to order them, where should they go to?
Visit our website at pardonmoi, pardonmoi.com. And like I said, we would love to hear feedback from people, whether they like them, whether they don't. That's really important data to have. So we encourage people to write in and let us know.
That's Amy Wicker, the creator of the Pardonmoi cards. 10% of the profits from the cards go towards food allergy research. Listening to Sidetrack. The foods we prepare for certain holidays define our experience and say a lot about who we are. Commentator Melissa Music explains how Christmas takes her back several decades to when she lived in Mule Shoe, Texas.
Nostalgia pie is a holiday staple. Potatoes were fluffier and cakes rose higher on that remembered Christmas table. As an antidote to the seasonal sense that I am missing some culinary mark established long ago, I reread my Aunt Jenny's cookbook. It was compiled in 1963 by the Women's Society of Christian Service of the First Methodist Church of Mule Shoe, Texas, where my aunt still lives. I like the salad section. No naked lettuce here, just the sweet, gelatinous molds and rings we called salad. Here's a recipe for Mrs. Owen Powell's Cherry Coke Salad. Take two Cokes. Heat one Coke and chill the other. Add the hot Coke to one package of cherry Jell-O. Let the Jell-O dissolve and then add the cold Coke. Drain one small can of crushed pineapple and pour it into the Coke Jell-O mixture. Then add a number 2 can of black Bing cherries, drained, and 1 cup of crushed pecans. Here comes my favorite part of the recipe. The next instruction reads simply, mold. It doesn't say with what. Hands, a whip and a chair, tiny organisms, just the directive, mold. Then one assumes the dish is chilled and, Lord help us, eaten. Cherry Coke salad might be on the table next to Mrs. Finley Pearson's frozen cheese salad. This one's a time saver. Mix 1 cup of heavy cream with 1/2 cup of mayonnaise. Add to all that whiteness 1 cup of grated cheese, 1 cup of crushed pineapple, 1/2 cup of pecans, and, for you health nuts, 1/2 cup chopped celery. Pour it in a mold and freeze it. Of course, there's always the woman who's traveled and has to flaunt it. Here's Mrs. B.Z. Beatty's recipe for beans a la chestnuts. This one bears a distinctly European lack of cane sugar, mayonnaise, and heavy cream, salad staples in the Texas of my childhood. You'll want a can opener here. Drain 2 1-pound cans of cut green beans, but be sure to reserve the bean liquid. You'll need it later. Place a layer of the beans in a 1 1/2 quart baking dish. Open a 5-ounce can of water chestnuts and layer the chestnuts over the beans. Pour 4 ounces of grated cheese over the beans and water chestnuts. Layer the rest of the beans on top of the cheese. Top it with 4 more ounces of cheese and the contents of 1 can of fried onion rings. Pour 1/3 cup of the bean liquid over the casserole and then bake the whole thing at 325 degrees for 30 minutes. Pour 3 fingers of Jack Daniels in a water glass and drink. Actually, that one's nowhere to be found, not even after the recipe for kraut burgers. But I've always found it instructive that Singleton Funeral Directors took out such a large ad in the cookbook. It's simple. Just First and Avenue F, phone 2860. I guess they figured that after enough frozen cheese salad, the information might come in handy.
That essay from Melissa Music. To come on the program, we find out what toys made it this year into the Toy Hall of Fame and talk with the editor and publisher of the Oxford American about their music issue. Stay tuned. You've got attuned to Sidetrack. With Christmas coming up, of course, lots of people, both young and old, are thinking about what toys will be appearing under the tree. And there are some toys that keep appearing year after year, generation after generation. Barbie dolls, Mr. Potato Head, teddy bears, and Lincoln Logs, just to name a few. Every year, the Strong National Museum of Play in Rochester, New York, adds a few of these classic toys into their National Toy Hall of Fame. Last we checked in with them in 2004, the Rocking Horse, Scrabble, and G.I. Joe had just made the list. I recently talked with Christopher Bench, Vice President for Collections and Chief Curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame, to see who made it in this year.
The two toys that made it into the Hall of Fame this year are the first electric, not electronic, toys that are amongst the 36 classic toys in the hall. And one of them's more than a century old, the Lionel Train, but the other one's a little newer, from 1963. That was the year that saw the first Easy Bake Oven, and those have remained on the market and in children's and adults' hearts ever since.
What is it about those two toys that propelled them into the Toy Hall of Fame?
Well, they met all three of our key criteria for every toy that's in the Hall of Fame. First is longevity. They have to be toys that are enjoyed by more than one generation. Second, they're icons, ones that anyone can recognize. And third, these are toys that promote qualities of discovery, creativity, learning, socialization. These aren't the toys that you just press a button and they do it all while you stand back and watch. So these are toys that have so much play value. There's endless hours of fun that can be done with setting up, the planning, the building the landscape for your Lionel train, for instance, or mixing up those mixes for your Easy Bake Oven, sampling the results. There is no single way to play with these, which means that they create great memories for kids and great opportunities to play in depth.
And that's the secret of a great toy.
Absolutely. As popular as TMX Elmo is this year, I've seen him. I think he's going to wear out his welcome in more than one home and in more than one child's life because he is so much automated. He doesn't require that you as a child or an adult bring much to it. And to me, that's not the mark of the very best toys, the most enduring ones.
Are there newer toys out there, things that are new, like the Elmos, which you think have the potential of becoming these iconic toys?
I do. One of the 12 toys that was shortlisted this year for the National Toy Hall of Fame, in addition to the Easy Bake and Lionel trains, was the Atari game system. And it received special recognition for being an innovator in the field of electronic games. Today we look back at Pong or Pac-Man, and they seem so simple, but they were revolutionary in changing how people played. And I believe that someday, maybe before long, these electronic games that people have the year they got that PlayStation 3 is going to be a memory that they treasure. And those are going to be the toys that are looked back with nostalgia, with fondness. They dominate so much of playtime today that I think they are going to have similar kinds of reaction to some of these older toys that are getting into the Hall of Fame right now.
Now, have you seen a change in the kinds of toys that kids are playing with and, the kinds of toys that are making it into the Hall of Fame?
There's a lot of continuity in toys, and we had more than 2,400 nominations from the public for 300 different toys this year, and I'm anticipating even more nominations this coming year. And there are some threads that keep running through these. There are favorite dolls, there are stuffed animals, there are construction toys of various sorts, there are also an element of electronic toys, but there's a lot that carries on. And even though our vehicles are now Hot Wheels and they're made of extruded plastic, perhaps, they're not so different in play than the cast iron vehicles of 100, 150 years ago.
Now, when people look into the Toy Hall of Fame and go to the Strong Museum of Play, what toy gets the most reaction from people? What is the number one toy?
I don't know that there's a single number one toy, but I have to say a lot of the strongest reactions and stories get attached to those two iconic toys, Barbie and G.I. Joe, who we keep in separate cases for the most part, but they do have a way of intermingling in play behavior as G.I. Joe gets hijacked to be a date for Barbie, whether he wants to be that or not, by girls in a household. And I don't know that Barbie very often gets enlisted into G.I. Joe play, but they are amongst the ones that I get the most detailed stories about how their play went.
Well, I have to tell you, my favorite toy on the list in the Hall of Fame, the cardboard box. That is absolutely my favorite because that is the epitome of simplicity and imagination.
Exactly. I was so thrilled to be part of that last year when we inducted the cardboard box. And we had been getting that suggestion for a number of years, and we said, you know, it's time to recognize what a tremendous imaginative power cardboard boxes have. Everything from shoebox size to what was always the ultimate in my suburban neighborhood growing up is when somebody got a refrigerator or something big like that, and you could fit more than one kid inside this cardboard box, whether you made it a rocket to the moon or a wagon train out west or a house, you name it, there was no limit on what that cardboard box could do for you.
Now, the Toy Hall of Fame, of course, is part of the Strong Museum of Play. Tell us about the museum and its mission.
We are the only museum in the world that's dedicated to the study of play and its artifacts. And by play, we mean the broadest sense. While we have the biggest collection of toys in the world, we also have play that covers adult occupations, everything from gardening to woodworking to shopping. We have a huge collection of shopping bags. So we play in so many different ways, and play is so essential for mental and physical health and child and adult development. We all need to play, and we felt that it was really crucial to recognize that and celebrate it. And we've devoted a huge structure, more than 500,000 artifacts in our collection. We just put on a $37 million addition to double the size of the museum. We're now the second largest children's museum in the nation, the third largest in the world, and we're not only displays, we're hands-on activities throughout the space, and something that people literally spend hours at, having fun playing in our space and experiencing memories of their own types of play.
You know, a few months ago, I interviewed an author by the name of Christopher Noxon. Are you familiar with him?
No.
He wrote a great book called Rejuvenile, where he talks about adults rediscovering play. Now, how do you think that your Toy Hall of Fame fits into that?
Well, one of the most frequent comments I overhear as I eavesdrop in our exhibits and in the National Toy Hall of Fame space is, oh, when I was your age, I had one of those, or here's how I played with it. And sometimes the kids are there rolling their eyes, but sometimes it's a really special kind of bonding, linking the generations moment, whether that's parents to children or grandparents to grandkids. And having had those same things, here's what I wished for my 10th birthday. Maybe you never even got it, but it's a thrill to see part of your past and your present right here at the museum, because we're not about celebrating famous people and their stuff. We're about celebrating everyday folks just like you and me and the things that all of us have grown up with and have experienced in our playtimes.
Now, if people want to, one, visit the Toy Hall of Fame, where should they go? And if they want to nominate a toy, where should they go?
It's all possible on our website, which is conveniently available at www.museumofplay.org. It tells you all about us in Rochester, New York, just 90 minutes away from Niagara Falls, so you can see two wonders of the world in one easy visit. And you can also come right onto the website, click on the National Toy Hall of Fame. There's a blank then that you can nominate your favorite toy, tell us some stories about it if you like. And this is beyond democratic. This isn't one person, one vote. You can vote every day, every hour of every day if you like, in order to make sure that your favorite toy gets an awareness of us here at the museum that it deserves a turn in the National Toy Hall of Fame.
And when will you be announcing next year's nominees or inductees?
You'll be hearing the two or three winners early next November. So you've got plenty of time to start lobbying for the toy that we've overlooked all along.
That's Christopher Bench, Vice President for Collections at Strong National Museum of Play and Chief Curator of the National Toy Hall of Fame. Both of those are located in Rochester, New York. This is Sidetrack. The Oxford American Magazine bills itself as the Southern magazine of good writing, combining a blend of reporting, fiction, and criticism. The magazine first surfaced in 1992 in Oxford, Mississippi, with the backing of novelist John Grisham. Some serious financial troubles forced the magazine to shut down 3 times in 9 years, but it's always bounced back. Last month for the afternoon magazine, Jeff Bosser talked with Mark Smirnoff, the editor and publisher of the Oxford American, about the revival of the magazine and their recent music issue.
Every year you release a music issue, and it's accompanied by a CD. We just heard a moment ago a few seconds of Going Back to New Orleans by Joe Liggins and his Honey Drippers. I'd like to play a few tracks off this CD and find out how you come about organizing all these songs. I mean, how many things do you have to choose from? There are 24 tracks in this CD. Every year you come up with a lot of stuff for, you know, you always have over 20-plus tracks on the CD. And there's no consistent style to any of them, several different genres, stuff from several generations. How big a pool do you have to pick these songs?
Well, I think we have basically all of American music to choose from. It's still sort of not recognized that all the important music genres, jazz, rock and roll, R&B, blues, country, came from the South. And to me, that's one of the shining contributions of this region. You know, people talk about Southern literature, but you know, for me, equally as important is the great music that's come from this region. So you know, it all started here, quite frankly. And you know, it people gobbled it up, whether they were living in New York, California, or Timbuktu. You know, Southern music is just pervasive.
Now, are these suggested by contributors, or where do you get some of the ideas to include?
Well, there's two things about our annual music issue philosophy. Number one is we want to put out a great party tape, a great mixtape. The kind of one may not be necessarily a big band fan, for example, but if it's a great song in the right mix, you'll listen to it. So we just want to mix it all up. The other aim is, all things being equal, we would rather celebrate and discuss a neglected artist versus a well-known one. Or if we dabble with the well-known ones, we'd rather have a fresh take on them or an obscure track of theirs. And so we get these ideas. Man, we're looking all year round. We look for hints everywhere. We'll listen to music writers. Musicians are a great source, because those guys and gals are passionate about the subject like no one else. And you know, one strange record will lead to another strange record. I mean, it's a maze out there, Jeff. It's crazy. We love it, but you know, it's just, there's so many great neglected Southern musicians.
Well, let's get right to it. Let's listen to something, and for the convenience of our board operator, I think we'll go with in the order the tracks appear on the CD, and one that I have a list of stuff that I thought we needed to include. Let's listen to Tex Williams here. Smoke,
oh,
smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette.
Yeah, that's great.
Now, I'm a feller with a heart of gold, with the ways of a gentleman, I've been told, the kind of a feller that wouldn't even harm a flea. But if me and a certain character met, the guy that invented the cigarette, I'd murder that son of a gun in the first degree. Now, it ain't cause that I don't smoke myself, and I don't reckon they hinder your health. I've smoked them all my life, and I ain't dead yet. But nicotine slaves are all the same at a petting party or a poker game. Everything's gotta stop while they have that cigarette.
Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you smoke yourself to death,
tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you hates to make him wait, but you just gotta have another cigarette.
Smoke,
right. Well, there's a sample of one of the songs off the Oxford American Southern Music CD. Just came out last month. Tex Williams, as I read a little bit about him, was actually a native of Illinois, Ramsey, Illinois, down near, not far from St. Louis. First time I heard this song, I thought how sarcastically this song could help tobacco lobbyists. But then I read it was included in the movie Thank You for Smoking. How'd you come across this one, Mark?
Well, actually, one of my co-workers here found it. And I heard of Tex Williams, but I'd never heard that track. And to me, man, that song just takes the top off of my head. I dare somebody who thinks he or she doesn't like country music to say the same thing after listening to that track. I mean, that band is so hot, and the lyrics are funny, and, you know, Tex, you hear Tex, and you'll never forget his voice. You hear him once, and he sticks with you. So, I mean, and, you know, as I say, I mean, to me, I don't see why that song shouldn't be on a CD collection that's aiming to be a great party tape. You know, we're not trying to be academic, because, I mean, I just hate approaching music in that way. To me, it has to be emotional and visceral and soulful. And, you know, thank God Southern music offers all of that almost all the time.
Here's an artist that I heard this and I thought, well, this has to come from the late 60s, early 70s. Track 8, Sharon Jones, How Long Do I Have to Wait for You? And then I found out it came out like last year. Let's give this one a listen off the Oxford American Southern Music CD. Artist Sharon Jones. The article about her, as the magazine itself has big long articles about every artist. It's entitled "Groovy with a High Chance of Funk." Sharon Jones, has she been kind of obscured and not really out in the mainstream?
Yes, and, she's originally from North Carolina, and she's an African American singer. And I think her band is a bunch of young white kids. But you know, she single handedly proves that soul music is ageless. I mean, that's one thing that we don't hear enough of, you know, contemporary artists playing soul music, because it has aged so well. You can't say that for everything. And every time I hear somebody playing soul music these days, it still, you know, if they're a good artist, it still sounds good. The other thing that just struck me is, you know, you just played an old country swing artist, Tex Williams, and then you just played after that a contemporary soul artist, and you know, they sound great next to each other. And the great evil in approaching music, to me, is to approach it by genre. I mean, I think music is either soulful or it's not. And if it's soulful, they go well together, no matter what genre a song happens to be. But just, you know, one thing we just love is mixing it up and battling against the evil of genres.
Here's another one that this is traditionally a jazz musician, as I came to find out, Bob DeRoen. In fact, I heard an interview you did on another an NPR program where you were championing him, and I didn't know anything about him other than this song, which I remember hearing as a kid on Schoolhouse Rock, "Three Is a Magic Number." Which is track 10. We'll go ahead and listen to that off the Oxford American Music CD.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number. It takes three legs to make a tripod or to make a table stand. It takes three wheels to make a vehicle called a tricycle. Every triangle has three corners. Every triangle has three sides. No more, no less. You don't have to guess. When it's three, you can see it's a magic number. A man and a woman had a little baby. Yes, they did. They had three in the family. That's a magic number. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30. 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30. Now the multiples of three come up three times in each set of 10.
People may recognize that song from Schoolhouse Rock in the early 70s. Talk about why you're such a big Bob Dorough fan, Mark.
Well, I am convinced that he is the great neglected American musical artist. He is, in addition to that song, which is a masterpiece, Bob is mainly just, you know, a hardcore jazz man. But luckily, he brings this distinctive wit to everything he does, and nobody sounds like him. I mean, the closest I can think to describe him, the closest comparison is maybe a combination of Mose Allison and Bob Dylan. He and Dylan certainly have some cosmic connection going on, but you know, he's an American original, and he's a little hard to, you know, his jazz stuff can be hard to almost get. I mean, he comes at you from left field, and he's a difficult voice at times. But once you let him kind of just warm over you, you become addicted, and it's. There's nobody like Bob Dorough, and you can even hear it in that song. Even though it's a pop song, you can hear his voice being a little bit strange, a little bit distinctive, kind of almost, you know, out of control in spots. But man, I could go on about that. You know, he's the only singer that Miles Davis ever put on an album of his. So, you know, this skinny white boy from Arkansas, Bob Dorough, you know, just hit people deep. Although he's, you know, people who know him are crazy about him, but not enough people know about him.
Well, as I figured, we wouldn't get to all the tracks I wanted to play. Let's skip ahead near the end here. And we've been talking about artists that have not been recognized. Let's go to track 22, Sam Cooke, a posthumous release, him recording the Tennessee Waltz.
Well, I was dancing with my baby to that Tennessee Waltz when an old friend I happened to see. Oh, yeah, I introduced him to my baby. And why? My friend stole my sweetheart away from me. Oh, yes, he did. But I remember the night and that beautiful Tennessee waltz. Only you know how much I.
Sam Cooke is also on the cover of the Oxford American Music CD, a magazine that actually came out last month. And this is not a recording that I've heard before.
Yeah, it's not one of the ones they play on the radio. And, you know, that's the tricky thing about those commercial radio stations, is that they just play the same stuff over and over again and thereby ignore perfectly serviceable gems in even a superstar's career like Sam Cooke's. So, you know, the one lesson I've learned about doing this music issue is that there are rewards to digging deep into all these different areas of music, all these different genres. I mean, it's amazing how many great artists have been forgotten. And partially I would blame commercial radio for that, because they just play the same doggone songs over and over again.
Can we talk quickly, in about 30 seconds? Tell me what's going on with your magazine. You're now a nonprofit and based in Conway, Arkansas, after some financial troubles.
Yes, sir. I think you mentioned, I think we've died three times and came back to life three times. But finally, we found the perfect home. It's so natural for us to be on a university campus. And we're working on a Southern movie issue with our first ever DVD and all sorts of weird and strange and wonderful ideas. We just had a concert with Bob Doro, so I'm still kind of palpitating over that. Guy's 84, and he still is just the ultimate showman and hypnotizer.
That's Mark Smirnoff, editor and publisher of the Oxford American Magazine. He spoke with Jeff Bossert last month as part of the Afternoon Magazine. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. This episode, as well as all the past episodes of Sidetrack, are available in real audio on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to WILL.UIUC.edu, click AM, and then select Sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of AM 580, WILL, Urbana.